It's Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. It's 1:38 in the morning. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio, high above Wacker Drive here on Michigan Avenue. Or no longer on Michigan Avenue, off Columbus Avenue, I guess, in the new WGN Radio studios on Columbus Avenue. Thank you very much for being with us until 5 a.m. David Soucy has been a guest of the show many times. His website is whyplanescrash.com. You can follow him on Twitter at David_Soucy, S-O-U-C-I-E, for lots of great air travel and any accident investigation involving transportation. David, good morning. Thanks so much for being with us. I want to say the last time we chatted was... there was an Amtrak crash a year or two ago, wasn't there? Something was it? God, I'm trying to remember now. In Canada?
Yeah, that's right. No, it was New York. I think is where it was, in the New York area.
Okay. Yeah, it's so funny how the time flies by and things run one into another. And then we talked a lot back when Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 went down, and you had your book about that a year or so later. But it's been a while, and I'm glad you were able to jump on with us tonight. Thank you so much. It's interesting.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. When I reached out to you earlier today, there was what was it? LaGuardia at first, and then I think was it Liberty International had to start canceling flights. Had a bunch of problems because of course, all of these air traffic controllers, all of the TSA security people, have been working without paychecks for about a month now. And you wondered when eventually something was going to happen. I know I had read a story that I want to say, and I apologize if I'm getting this wrong. A spokesperson for the I think the air traffic controllers was saying people are making mistakes they haven't made in 10 and 15 years because now we're being overworked. There's a lot of stress because of the paychecks and all sorts of problems going on. And then this came to a head, and suddenly tonight, late on Friday night or later in the day on Friday, we have an agreement to reopen the government for 3 weeks. How much, and I don't mean to make you put a political hat on here, but how much of an effect do you think the issues we started having with the FAA played on the fact that the two sides suddenly came together to reopen the government for 3 weeks?
Unfortunately, I think that's one of the main reasons that something did go down today, because it waits and they wait until there's only lives at risk, and then that are really at risk, and not some kind of down the road thing. It's right now. It's happening now. There were 7,100 planes sitting there waiting to land that couldn't because there was so much backup today.
Did you say 7,100?
Yes. Yep.
Wow. So
there's
so
typically on any given time it was more like maybe 700, but not 7,100. There were that many planes circling, waiting to land.
And that's just crazy. And that's not just at those two airports. That must be nationwide because of what happens when planes are late and things like that. That the whole system gets mucked up.
Exactly. Yes.
That's crazy. Now, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit. I know you're saying that it's not till lives are at risk that they take action. My guess is, and this is the cynic in me, is that it wasn't lives at risk that made anybody take action. It was the economy at risk that made people take action, because I think if air travel slows down to a crawl, that truly will affect the economy, because so much business is done by people traveling across the country to meetings and things like that, politicians realize this is going to be our undoing. If we shut down airline travel because of this, that's going to hurt us all, or one side or the other, whoever caved. But I think that the economy, I mean, how dependent is our U.S. economy on all of those flights happening every day?
Incredibly dependent on that. But I do want to go back to the lives at risk thing, because, you know, for 15 years, I was in charge of making sure that our budget, our FAA budget, got through to Congress and got passed. And we never had problem passing that budget because of the fact that there was never a congressman or a senator that wanted to be the one that didn't pay for the things that take us, that sure, keep us safe. You know, and so you'd end up, if someone said, no, we're not going to pay for the FAA to keep the FAA running, then you've got a lot of safety things that are happening, that if there was an accident, that no congressman wanted to be the one that say, hey, we didn't have enough the air traffic controllers or enough inspectors out there looking at safety for the airlines. So no one wanted to do that. So it's always been used as a tool. The FAA has always been used as a tool because it scares people. It's something you do every day, and it's something that no one wants to be the one that puts it at risk.
So, David, in all that time that you were in charge of getting Congress to approve that budget, I imagine at some point while you were doing that, there was a government shutdown. I know previous government shutdowns have been a very short amount of time. Never, you know, this is what this was about double the length of the previous longest one, right? When you were part of that, what I don't understand is how in the world, because essential employees still get paid even during the shutdown. It's, you know, there's these weird tiers of some people just get laid off and you don't get paid and you don't work until this is over. Some people are deemed so essential that they work and they get paid, right? But then there's a third group sandwiched in the middle that's like, you know, you're kind of important, so you got to keep working, but you're not so important that we're going to pay you. And somehow that is where TSA and air traffic controllers have fallen. And I do not understand, like you talk about, the safety that's at risk here. How in the world are those workers not deemed essential enough that they keep getting paid during a government shutdown?
Yeah, there were a couple of furloughs while I was, or government shutdowns in which we did not, we're not supposed to be paid, we're not supposed to be going to work even, but as essential employees, I was working out of Washington, D.C., and we were essential. There's a tier between what's essential for safety, for the safety of the country, and what's essential for the operation of the country. There's two different tiers. Mm-hmm. So when the tier gets down to the operation of the country, which is TSA and air traffic controllers, that's a tier that's been passed, and it never, in my career, it's never gotten to the level of getting to that operational tier where they take those operationally essential personnel and stop paying them. So this was really news to me today when I heard of it. And the only thing I can speculate is once when the government was shut down before the PATCO strike, if you remember that many years ago, that at that time there was a different organization in charge of air traffic control. And now the organization that's in charge of it evidently isn't considered operationally essential.
It doesn't make any sense, especially in light of September 11th. I know that's a while back now, but you would think that, you know, that is the safety of the country, that if we don't have people watching things and don't have people in control of things and overseeing like TSA does, like air traffic does, that's such a danger to the country. I would hope that after this, hopefully, once they work everything else out, that our senators and representatives come together to say, okay, next time this happens, because let's face it, it's not like it's never going to happen again, these people are deemed essential. They have to be paid. We have to keep the safety and the economy going if we're going to have a shutdown. It's just stunning to me.
Yeah, the Aviation Subcommittee is that entity that could do that. They could pull that off, and they certainly need to look at it. Oberstar was the last one that was really a predominant head of the Aviation Subcommittee. That was 15 years ago, but at that time he really stood forward and said, look, this is something that's essential to the country. We're never going to shut it down, and let's keep it moving. But evidently that has slipped under the current Aviation Subcommittee.
David, jumping around a little bit here, it's been a while, and I don't want to be a jinx or anything, but have we had an unprecedented run of overall airline safety here in the United States in the last 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, in the United States, that's very true. It's been incredibly unprecedented, and I think it's due a lot to the change that the FAA and the airlines themselves have started working together to be more transparent about safety and understand how the whole system works. One of them was a project that I worked on. It was called OASIS, and another one was called the FSAS, Flight Standards Automation Systems. And those are safety systems that were put in place and patterned after the Sandia Laboratories safety systems, which is used in the nuclear industry. So that's really what's changed a lot, is just the way that we view safety and the cultural aspects of what kind of things, what is safe, what are the standards that we're going to have to maintain in order to be safe. And I think those are panning out now.
Is some of it also related to a lot of Boeing and Airbus have sold a lot of airplanes in the last 10 to 15 years, and I think a lot of our airlines have modernized their fleets. Is that part of it as well?
Yeah, there's a project, this was back in the late 90s, early 2000s, that was the Aging Aircraft Initiative, and that started after Air Alaska crashed when, I don't know if you recall that one, where the convertible airplane, the top of the airplane came off, and that started an incredible in-depth study of how long can airlines last, how long can they fly without falling apart. And so the aging aircraft was really behind a lot of that as to why these airplanes or why the aircraft have been retired and put back into service.
And speaking of new aircraft, so Boeing has this new 737 MAX jet, which I think is the one that has been kind of a viral video of its test flights where they take off at like a 90-degree angle and all this kind of fun stuff you see them doing in a test flight. But Lion Air had a crash with a Boeing 737 MAX. That was back on October 29th. I think just in the last week or so, they finally got the black box and the voice recorders. I don't think we've got too much details yet, but what are you hearing about what happened there?
Well, with Boeing, it really has to do a lot with the thought that technology advances much more quickly than our systems and even the human brain can conceive of all of the possibilities of what could happen. Now, they're so complex and so automated that we start relying on that. But in this case, what had happened was that Boeing felt that it wasn't necessary to tell the pilots about a particular fail-safe system that they had put into the aircraft. So when they were in an automated mode, if you turn off your autopilot, then it shouldn't really be doing anything to control the airplane. Whereas because they had added this extra safety feature, the pilot wasn't aware of that, and the airplane continued to reduce power and reduce thrust in certain areas where the pilot wasn't ready for it. So the details, it gets really highly technical at that point as to what happened in that particular incident. And like you said, the report's not out yet, but Boeing has really come back and said, look, we messed up. We should have told people what happens here. There's a few lines in the manual that say this is what is going to happen, but they didn't make it part of their training program. They didn't say, hey, we have this new way of doing things. And that's only one of many things. But I think that looking forward, that's going to be our biggest challenge in safety is how do we maintain the human aspect of how they interface with these highly technical advanced autopilots and auto systems.
Well, so a lot of it comes down to training, making sure that the right training is getting to them and that they have enough time to train when the technology has really changed on an aircraft. So is it really coming down to Boeing saying, yeah, we changed this and we didn't tell the pilots?
Yes, that's really where it is. They've already made some changes to the manuals and to the training, which I really applaud Boeing for doing. You know, they could have just sat back and waited and said, look, we're going to wait till they come out with a reason for this accident, but they didn't. They said, look, we see how we could improve things. We're not going to worry about accepting responsibility or anything. We're just going to say, hey, look, this is not the right way to do it. We need to change that, and they are changing it right away, not waiting for down the road to point fingers at somebody else.
Yeah. Well, that brings us back to one of the great mysteries of the modern era now, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Remind us again the title of the book that you wrote on that crash, David.
Oh, it's a ridiculously long title, but it's Malaysia Airlines MH370, Why It Disappeared and Why It's Only a Matter of Time Before It Happens Again.
And refresh us real quick, your theory on what happened in that crash was...
Well, it really comes down to two different possibilities. One is something nefarious, where the aircraft was brought off course and intentionally ditched somewhere. That's less likely in my book. I use an algorithm that I've been using for 20 years on aircraft accidents. I take the verifiable facts and compare them to each other and validate them that way. So by doing that, it was more likely in my mind that there was actually a fire on board and that the pilots had steered the aircraft away, because the first turn that they made was directly towards their major maintenance base, the place that you would fly this. So you think of all the 360 degrees that you could have turned the aircraft to, they chose the one place that would be the direction they would fly to their major maintenance base if something critically wrong with the aircraft, knowing that it wasn't going to take off again and had to get back to the major maintenance base. So that's my first speculation, and there's the book goes into much detail about why I believe that, but I think that's the most likely still in my mind, even after knowing and finding parts and pieces of the aircraft. I think it still aligns with that thought.
So I've talked to various, I've talked to you and like three or four different people who either study crashes or wrote books over time. One gentleman named Larry Vance wrote a book a couple of years ago. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's an award-winning accident investigator from Canada. And he says that, you know, to him, it's case, I think the title of his book is Case Closed. And he says it definitely was done purposefully. And he says there's, you know, that if you look at all of the data that's come out, especially maybe even since your book's come out, they were avoiding the turns and things they made. They were avoiding detection, and that the way the pieces that have been found look like the plane was intentionally tried to land on the water, or else, because if he believes if it would have just run out of fuel, it would have crashed violently. And because of the way pieces have been found, the few pieces that have been found, he believes these guys intentionally, or one of the pilots, intentionally was trying to put this plane somewhere where it would never be found. Do you think there's any validity to that?
Well, at this point, no one knows, so there's validity to any speculation that you may have. But to say that the case is closed before there's even evidence of that is irresponsible on Larry's part. And I know Larry, and I admire him and respect him, and I've heard that and read his book. There's one key point that he points out that I think is totally erroneous, and that's the location of the flapper on the flap that was found in the ocean. Had the aircraft, which I believe came off in the air, I don't think it even came off by hitting the water. If it had come off hitting the water, then the leading edge of that thing would have been destroyed. I've done enough aircraft accidents to know what happens to airplanes when they hit the water. And that piece of the aircraft would have been lunged forward into its mounting, and that's not the way this thing came off at all. It came off, and there would have been bending and warping on this flap run, and there was none of that. No evidence of that whatsoever, indicating that the aircraft did come down rapidly, but it came down in a way that would not have been controllable. It would have been, just like you said, a violent crash, but it would have hit the water in such a way that it was not intentionally tried to be landed. If it was, then the flapper on would have been destroyed in a different way. It would have been twisted and pulled backward. It's kind of hard to describe over the radio what would have happened, but it just, the pieces of the aircraft that we have found have shown, it hit the ground violently. No one tried to land that airplane. And that's what he's claiming that did happen, is that there was somebody conscious and aware. Two things wrong with that, too, is there wasn't enough oxygen on board to turn off and kill everybody on board and still be able to make that flight the rest of the way. There's reasons for that as well. Anyway, I could spend all night talking about things that dispute, and he could spend all night disputing the things that I put in my book as well, because simply there's just no facts. Right. There's very little that we can go by, but to say that the case is closed in the middle of something where there is no smoking gun, I think is just trying to put a case and a close on things that, as accident investigators, that's what we do. We want to know the answers, so we find those answers, and just through that prejudice that we have in our own mind, we make things up to fill in the gaps. And I think that's what Larry got into with his book.
David, now that the official search is over for MH370, what do you think happens? Is that plane found in our lifetime?
I really don't think it is now. I don't think it's possible to find that airplane unless it's just some very, very strange thing that happens during some other kind of exploration or a piece of evidence floats up. But even then, I don't know where they'll find the actual the black boxes or anything like that. The thing that we have working for us, though, is if we do find that, those black boxes, the way that they're constructed in today's world, that evidence is still sitting at the bottom of the ocean and always will be. If we do find it, there will be answers, but I don't think it's very likely that we will.
David Soucy's website is whyplanescrash.com, and find him on Twitter. He's a great follow on Twitter, David_Soucy, S-O-U-C-I-E, David_Soucy. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. It's always great to talk to you. I hope we do it again soon.
Oh, you as well. I sure appreciate you having me on the show. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. David Soucy, again on Twitter, David_Soucie.com.